Welcome to the Background Briefing podcast. This week, back to prison. More than half the people in prison will re-offend and return. This recidivism creates a huge cost burden on the public purse. So why is a highly respected service that's worked with prisoners on release in New South Wales for 50 years being dropped? Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Anne Arnold. Most people in prison have been there before.
I don't want to ever get in a position where I'm likely to be in that sort of place where that might possibly happen again.
After being released, the challenges of slotting back into society and changing previous lifestyles are huge. Crime researcher Don Weatherburn says that more than half the prison population will re-offend in their lifetime.
Many of those who are locked up will be back. 60% if you're non-Aboriginal, 72% if you're Aboriginal, but more than 20% of the population in jail is Aboriginal.
Well, I've got to be on my toes all the time as far as sobriety is concerned. I got to keep away from places and people and faces and things that prompt me back down the path of drinking, yeah.
John, an Aboriginal man, recently served 4.5 years for manslaughter. On his release, he was categorised by the New South Wales Department of Corrective Services as medium to high risk of re-offending.
Probably because of my history of alcohol abuse and drug abuse, yeah.
And does that tend to bring out violence for you?
Yes, it does, yeah. Very intermittent as it is, but very serious when it happens, yeah, very serious.
Australian prison numbers are rocketing, and so is the cost to the states and territories. The national average cost is $290 a day for each prisoner. Don Weatherburn, director of the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research, says governments should be focusing on recidivism above all else.
Well, it's hugely important. We tend to preoccupy ourselves with creating alternatives to prison, forgetting that most people going to prison this year or last year are actually going back to prison. Now, once you realise that, most of the leverage in reducing the prison population can be obtained by reducing the rate of return to prison rather than reducing the number of people who go there in the first instance. And that tends to have been neglected.
But there's a critical lack of support and accommodation to help offenders stay on track when they return to the community.
I think that if my housing was threatened or taken from me in some way, shape or form, that it would threaten my sobriety and my sanity, which would make everything, it would just crumble through the floor, you know. I'd just go through the floor and be back where I was.
Governments continue to spend much more on locking people up than on the cheaper option of preventing them returning to jail.
It's dumb public policy, it's dumb economics, it's costing the taxpayer an enormous amount for these people to be continually re-offending and reincarcerated, and we really need to look at a better way of investing the public dollar that encourages that reintegration into society so that people who are released from prison can make that valuable contribution to society.
Lou Schetzer from the New South Wales Public Interest Advocacy Centre. In New South Wales, the only organisation that specialises in long-term offender reintegration is about to wind up. For 50 years, CRC, the Community Restorative Centre, has been supporting ex-prisoners with a high risk of re-offending. But a shift in government policy means CRC's intensive casework won't be funded.
I think it's absolutely crucial that services like CRC continue to exist, because we've seen through our limited consultation study, and I know that CRC have seen through their own casework, of the enormous value of this service. So it would be extremely disappointing for those services to be cut back in any way.
The CRC runs several programs, but its core business of supporting high-risk offenders over 2 years or more is ending. Specialist caseworkers are being let go in Inner Sydney, Parramatta, Newcastle and Broken Hill. A new round of government tenders prioritises short-term services. Clients such as Lee worry about friends still in jail who now won't receive the support she's had.
I just sit here and think, where would I be? Because I'm so happy where I am. But where will them girls go? And they'll just go reoffend. And it scares me to think maybe that would have been me.
Prisoner rehabilitation, or reintegration, inevitably gets drowned out by the noise of law and order politics.
Ever since the mid-90s, it's been this endless spiral of, you know, who's the toughest on crime? I'll whip him with a rattan, he'll bring out the chopping block. It was completely ludicrous.
Michael Pelly is a legal journalist, and he was the media advisor to the recently dumped New South Wales Attorney General, Greg Smith. Greg Smith was a reformist in a Conservative government. He wanted to reduce jail numbers and, in particular, to tackle recidivism. As we'll hear later, he would pay the price for his approach.
Come in.
Thank you.
Bon soir, s'il vous plaît.
Might need to turn the TV off, so...
You think?
For the past year, John has lived in a small flat available through the CRC, the Community Restorative Centre. It's in a 70s red brick building next to a railway line. AJ Phillip has been his caseworker.
You can't have a glass, you just have to have a mug, mate.
That's even better.
The building is owned by a community housing organisation. The only way John can be there is because he has AJ to help him manage things. It's an agreement that CRC has with a couple of different housing groups to provide supervised accommodation for people who've left jail and would otherwise have few options. The caseworker is part of the package. Before jail, John had lived in Redfern where, one long, drunken night, he killed a man.
Yeah, it was December, so the sun goes down about 7-ish, so, like, and the last thing I sort of remember was standing on the guy's balcony, well, not the victim's balcony, but the guy's place who it was, standing on his balcony, and, admiring the view about sundown. That's the last thing I remember, and apparently the incident occurred at 2:30 or thereabouts the next morning. So what happened between then and 2:30 the next morning... I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I haven't got a story. He's dead because of me. And I've got to cart that around for the rest of my born days.
When he left jail, John wasn't allowed to live around the Redfern area anymore. That was a parole condition. But there was no affordable accommodation available anywhere else.
I was talking to a welfare officer, and they're hard enough to get access to in jail. And he suggested CRC to me, and he gave me a sort of brief rundown, and in that he said, oh, well, they'll be able to provide you with short-term accommodation coming out that parole will definitely approve. You'll be helped to be plugged in with various services, and you'll be transitioned out of the jail environment back into the community and helped possibly even further with medium to long-term accommodation. And I jumped out of my seat and way furiously and said, yes, 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 oh, thank God, yes. How soon can we get this happening? He said, settle down, son, settle down. You'll have to go on the list. And things, the ball started rolling from there. And I eventually met young AJ here, and that's how we got that kicking, yeah. The long and the short of it is I would still be in custody today were it not for CRC.
If John were still in jail, it would be costing the state between $200 and $300 a day to keep him there. With CRC supporting John in this flat until he has permanent accommodation and can live independently, it's costing the government a third of that, an estimated $70 a day. There are other benefits. John has been sober for nearly 2 years, the longest period of sobriety, he says, outside of his four-year jail term. And with CRC's prompting, he's been talking to university medical students about hepatitis C and has an ongoing role as a Hep C ambassador.
There's been the opportunity for all of that, and what I've got out of it, the self-worth that I've built through it, that my kids have seen me actually do something instead of like fall around and slobber and dribble and talk shit and carry on like a pork chop. They've gotten to know me. And I've rediscovered me. I rediscovered I've got a vocabulary. I rediscovered I had a fucking mind. I had all these things hiding in the background somewhere that, like, I'd covered up for years.
Drug addiction can be, often is, usually is, a lifelong struggle, just like alcoholism. So my hope is that that will help a lot of people be able to turn their lives around if they can get off the drugs, get a job, get somewhere to live and get help rather than just being thrown into jail. It'll be better for the community generally. We'll have more citizens that might have been permanent criminals going straight.
Greg Smith, the most recent New South Wales Attorney General, had, before entering politics, been the Deputy Director of Public Prosecutions. He's still a Liberal Party MP and declined an interview. But in a speech to a defence lawyers' conference in 2012, he said he used to be a hardliner, but his thinking had changed. He now understood that people in prison had often grown up in deprived areas.
Well, you shouldn't be surprised that a lot of those people turn to crime, and then they find it hard to get out of it because they often haven't had education or much education. Some of them have learning problems, but others just weren't interested. They weren't encouraged. So that has sunk in much more since I've been in Parliament, where I've had to look away from just the prosecution side, at the defence side, and at the community generally, and working out, well, why isn't this working, this law and order push?
Greg Smith said he realised recidivism was a huge issue.
And also we want to reduce New South Wales' reoffending rate by focusing more on rehabilitation rather than retribution, to keep people away from what I call, it's getting a bit hackneyed, the university of crime, prison or detention. That's not being soft on crime, it's being smart on crime. Thanks for your attention.
It's on drugs, like, you know, smoking eyes and using heroin at the same time. It's homeless, living at mate's house here and there, and just, yeah, just living day to day.
Bradley grew up in the Vietnamese community and started using heroin in Sydney's Cabramatta district when he was 13. He's now 30 and he's been out of jail for 4 years after a lifetime of short sentences for theft, drug charges and vehicle offences. When we met, Bradley was tired. He'd just done a night shift in a bakery. CRC's AJ Phillips has been working with him for several years.
I was lost at the time, you know, like I didn't know, like, what the future was like. Yeah,
how just, to change the old pattern.
Yeah, just like, yeah, just didn't know how to change old patterns, and it's even harder when you got no, like, like a support network. In my case, that, like, I don't talk to my family. I'm basically like alone 24, like 7, you know, and only person that's there and that is. It's CRC, you know?
The struggle for Bradley and others to rebuild their lives isn't heard in the bellicose politics of law and order.
Now, we've got a weak-kneed Attorney General and Attorney General's Department in New South Wales.
There's no louder voice than Sydney shock jock Ray Hadley, who ran a concerted campaign against former Attorney General Greg Smith and his weak-kneed approach to crime.
My God, what's it going to take? Will it take Greg Smith's son to be killed, Barry O'Farrell's son to be killed, before someone does something about it? What's it going to take, men? Hang your head in shame, Barry. Hang your head in shame, Greg Smith. And the New South Wales Cabinet, hang your heads in shame. You don't deserve to serve another term in government.
When Barry O'Farrell was replaced as Premier by Mike Baird last month, it was widely predicted that Greg Smith would be dropped as Attorney General, largely because of his stance on law and order. And he was. His former media adviser, Michael Pelly, is a long-time legal journalist still writing for The Australian. He's previously been an adviser to Philip Ruddock as Federal Attorney General in the Howard government. Michael Pelly says Greg Smith's interest in keeping people out of jail where possible was popular for a while, including with the new Premier, Mike Baird, who was then the Treasurer.
That was very popular in some sectors of the government, including in the Treasury sector, because we were actually looking at the prison numbers and crime had been coming down, and the population had fallen under 9,500. From the first time, we looked at the thing, well, we don't need all these jails. We can actually close a few of them. And the treasurer thought this was tremendous, you know, less money. Again, those figures, $70,000 a year for an adult, $250,000 a year for a juvenile, that adds up to a lot of beds, hospital beds you can provide, and a lot of deficit and infrastructure you can build. That was all going very well until the pressure went on and the whole notion that anybody would be seen as soft on crime.
Michael Pelly describes the pressure applied by 2GB's Ray Hadley.
In fact, the most pressure, I should say, came from one particular announcer on 2GB, Ray Hadley. Ray has very solid links to the police and has a very particular view about law and order policy. And his voice is extremely influential. Each state parliamentary office up at Parliament has a radio selection. And I can assure you that from 9 o'clock till 12 o'clock, I'd say 80% of parliamentarians had Ray Hadley on the radio and had Ray Hadley telling them for a good 4 months that Greg Smith was soft on crime, was a raving lunatic, that Barry should sack him, that the state was going to pot and what are we going to do? Barry, save us, get rid of Greg Smith, please. And once that pressure goes on day after day after day after day, it becomes a bit wearing. You look for little victories, and when there are none coming, all your colleagues look to you. And it's more about an erosion of support in supplies. Yes, Greg, we support what you're doing, became, do you know what you're doing? Law and order was meant to be one of our strengths. We're a conservative government. We are meant to show to the community that the safety and security of its citizens is paramount. Even if some bloke breaks into my house and Greg Smith says to me, well, maybe we can turn him away for a life of crime. Well, guess what? I don't care about turning him away for a life of crime. I care about retribution. I'm the victim. I'm meant to be the centre of this whole process.
And it was in fact a safer community that Greg Smith was working towards as well.
This is the whole folly of the exercise, that it doesn't allow for a nuanced approach. It doesn't allow for someone to say we have a different approach for serious hardened criminals who are just, there are some people are just born bad. And no matter what you do, you're not going to turn them around. But there are some people, and don't forget, we were a penal colony founded on the idea that people could get a fresh start. Macquarie emancipated the convicts, you know, made them productive members of society.
Michael Pelly, former advisor to the New South Wales Attorney General.
Brent takes a lot of pride in his place, and it's always looked amazing every time I've come by.
I like your fish tank.
Oh, thank you. The orange one is the African, chicklids.
There's a yellow one.
If Bradley wants to become a productive member of society, he can't go back to his old drug-using networks. He's a rugby league fan, so his CRC caseworker, AJ, has tried connecting him to the community that way.
Are you going to go play Oztag sometime, anytime soon?
Yeah, people bug me about that. Yeah, went a couple of times and, yeah, need a bit of improvement.
So he started to come along to just social football games, the local, just meeting people down there and playing footy, and that's been a really good thing, as well as some exercise as well.
Yeah, we got a tragic Bulldog supporter right here. So.
It was something that he was already interested in, and just a really easy avenue, really welcoming bunch down there, and now it's just about twisting his arm to get down there a bit more.
A redesign of New South Wales government tenders means this kind of ongoing support will barely exist. Under the new corrective services contracts, there is 1 9-month program for 20 high-risk clients per year. The main transitional program is for 3 months only. That's for 540 people. Some clients may be extended for a second 3 months. The Department of Corrective Services declined an interview request because the tendering process is still underway. But in a written statement, the department said that the highest risk of reoffending is in the first 3 months after release, and that the new package of short-term programs represents an increase in funding. You can read the full statement at the Background Briefing website. 5,500 prisoners were released in New South Wales last year. Up to half the prison population has a mental health disorder. A significant minority, up to 15%, have a cognitive impairment. Professor Eileen Baldry from the University of New South Wales has found a number of these problems overlap.
What is, though, particularly concerning and worrying is that of those people with either a cognitive impairment or a mental health disorder, over 70% have a whole range of things. They don't just have one impairment or disorder. And so they are significantly disadvantaged in seeking support.
Professor Baldry says the most useful kind of program for people deemed at high risk of reoffending is multifaceted and versatile.
Really, the kind of program we need and that we know works is some people call it wraparound, some people call it holistic, some people call it a fully supported housing project. That's the kind of program that is the most useful, because what it does, it addresses either sequentially or sometimes at the same time a lot of those issues.
I have a current client who's in her mid-30s, who does use drugs, who is illiterate, who is often find herself in violent relationships, and quite recently then was knocked unconscious by a partner.
Geraldine Binko is a women's caseworker with the CRC.
And I just often wonder about her cognitive ability due to long-term drug use, also the violence and the number of times she's been knocked unconscious, and my ability then to have her assessed. So I contacted RBIAS, which is a brain injury unit who does assessments, and their waiting list was a minimum of a year. So even to find out what we're dealing with this woman, how can we support her, how can we help her, is really limited, because we don't really know what she's dealing with. Her memory is really, really bad. Her memory could be bad because of the drugs, could be bad because of the violence and how often she's been hit on the head, and her horrific traumatic childhood would be another factor in all that.
And if she's still using, what can you hope for there? What are you trying to achieve with her?
Well, I'm trying to get her into a long-term rehab. So have her detoxed and then get her into a long-term rehab. But again, she doesn't have a mobile phone. She loses them all the time, so she never has one. It's really hard to stay in contact with her, so I just literally turn up at her house a lot of her home a lot of the time and sort of catch her.
And is she pleased to see you when you turn up?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She is one of the ladies who saves up all her bills and all her letters, any correspondence that comes in, and asks you to read it. And so I make phone calls and, you know, sort out stuff for her, you know, because often stuff's late because she hasn't paid it because she can't read it. She's a lovely lady. But again, she doesn't present well. You know, she's only in her 30s. She doesn't have any teeth. She is often unwell. She has major illnesses on various levels. But she's just very traumatised, very complex. But her achievement now is that since she's been with us, she hasn't gone back to jail.
For how long?
Well, I've been working with her since I've started with this organisation, so, you know, nearly 3 years.
And is that the longest she's been out of jail?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So for her, that's a massive achievement.
Geraldine Binko, one of the CRC caseworkers. She has around 12 clients. There's little empirical evidence in Australia on what works in post-release support, but Eileen Baldry says overseas research suggests you need at least 2 years of wraparound support.
Work in, particularly in the United Kingdom, some in Canada and a bit in the United States, shows very clearly that the recidivism rates from those kind of programs are very low. They're very low over time. So, you know, over 2 years, you get a much lower return.
The CRC's transition program works with an average of 224 people a year. The prison return rate for those clients is 1 in 10 after 1 year, and that's much lower than the state average. Eileen Baldry is on the CRC's advisory committee. She says its 50 years of specialisation makes it invaluable.
They have around 50 years experience in developing ways to work with people who have been in prison. One of the things I have seen over 25 years of researching and working sort of in this area is that I see time and again mainstream services say, oh, well, you know, this person's not ours. They're too difficult, or they've come out of prison, or they should be looked after by corrective services.
This is health or housing. Yes. They're saying that too hard
yes.
for us.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Particularly health, some community housing. So you have to have an organisation that trains its workers. So CRC trains its workers. And in fact, they train a whole range of other organisations too in what are the things that you have to be alert to, the ways in which you work to support somebody.
Eileen Baldry says that while most reoffending does occur in the first 3 months, for the high-risk offenders, much longer is needed.
Post-release, you really need skilled workers and you need time. This is not something which is going to be addressed in 3 months or 6 months.
Under the new model in New South Wales, there will be some additional three-month accommodation services. Last year, the Public Interest Advocacy Centre released a report called Beyond the Prison Gates, which surveyed 26 jail leavers. The report's author, Lou Schetzer, found that one-third of those with no support had slept rough on their first night out of jail. Others had short-term crisis accommodation only.
Their accommodation situation was going to expire within a couple of months. And after that point of time, they did not know what they were going to do. They basically were very fatalistic and negative about their perception of the future. They thought it was likely they were just going to end up sleeping rough, returning to the street, or that they saw it as a very valid option to commit an offence, to go back inside, because at least they'll have some secure housing there.
Lou Schetzer found that by contrast, a group of 10 people in the survey who had a CRC caseworker and accommodation had a very different outlook.
The people that we spoke to who had accessed the services of Community Restorative Centre were far more positive and far more optimistic about their future. Importantly, they had started speaking to the workers from CRC prior to their release, so that there was a quite a comprehensive exit plan for them upon their release, and they were ready for a number of the challenges that they were going to face upon their release.
Victoria has a lower recidivism rate than New South Wales. The biggest provider of post-release services in Victoria is ACSO, the Australian Community Support Organisation. It's tendering for the two transition programs in New South Wales, the three-month one and the very small nine-month one. But Vaughan Winther, ACSO's deputy CEO, says the contracts have shortcomings.
I think what you can try to achieve in 3 months is quite limited. I think for some people they may not need that much, depending on what their circumstances are, but for others you'll need more. So I think that a good program design should be around flexibility. That's probably our biggest issue, is around the flexibility.
Under the New South Wales model for the higher risk group, where the needs are very complex, would you agree that the skills needed of those workers need to be pretty advanced?
Absolutely.
Is the pay rate high enough within that contract to attract those people?
Probably not. It's something that is a concern for us, but it's something which I think is probably manageable. Otherwise, we wouldn't have bid for it.
Vaughan Winther from the Australian Community Support Organisation in Victoria. The New South Wales contracts have been designed and will be awarded without the benefit of external evaluations. There is no data in either Victoria or New South Wales to show what happens to clients after they leave support services. And even though ACSO in Victoria works with 15,000 people a year across different parts of the justice system, it doesn't get evaluated by the government that funds it.
We haven't seen that happen for some period of time. You know, most of our services are just funded directly. There's not a lot of either inbuilt or integrated evaluation. And the evaluation shouldn't be done by us. It should be done externally and it should be done independently. But there's not a lot of that goes on.
In New South Wales, the CRC met recently with Don Weatherburn at the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research to see if an evaluation could be done. But Don Weatherburn told them they would need at least 600 people to study and a control group of the same size to get a meaningful result.
You get caught in a vicious circle. You can't show the program successful, so you can't attract additional funds. But if you don't attract additional funds, you can't scale the program up so that it can be evaluated.
Don Weatherburn says in general there's inadequate research into correctional programs.
For a very long time, politicians didn't really care too much about evidence-based policy. They were more concerned with pacifying the public, acting tough, looking like they were not going to give anyone an even break, that sort of politics of law and order.
Don Weatherburn from the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research. The CRC is now exiting its clients. It will tender for the new programs, but even if successful, it would only receive a quarter of the funding it's had, so couldn't continue its long-term work.
What I'm worried about is that after June, I will not have any further support in the way I have with Geraldine, and I feel a little lost now.
Lee is one of the CRC clients being exited, so she'll lose the support of caseworker Geraldine Blinko.
I have family court in July, so it's going to be hard.
Geraldine's been going to you with your family court appearances?
She's been there for every one of them, just about. And even if it's a 5-minute session, she's been there. And just to have that person, and to get that call that morning and say, we're meeting, and it's just that strength to get there and get through the day.
And the family court, do you want to explain what's happening there?
Because I was in prison, my son's with his dad, and I haven't seen him.
Lee served 9 months in jail for fraud in her workplace where she had an admin job. She was addicted to poker machines and continues to suffer from anxiety and depression.
Lee comes from a very unstable, unsupportive background, and it seems that her family is playing a part in that as well.
My thing in my life is my mum I'm scared of, and I had to go to counselling with my son, and Geraldine was coming and just being there, and my mum turned up once, and it was the scariest day for me, and Geraldine was there to get me through it and, you know, made sure I had the support and I felt safe, and it didn't hurt me like it used to.
Geraldine probably won't be able to be at an all-important family court case in June. Lee may also lose her small house on Sydney's bushy southern fringe. It's provided through CRC's housing partnership. She has been supported by a good local GP and a Salvation Army congregation.
You know, I sit at church and I listen to what they talk about and how I can use it in my life, and I sit there and I'll be in tears at something and think about something because, you know, I'll be reflecting, and I even think all these people must look at me and think all she does is cry. And I even felt guilty and thought maybe I should just tell them. And then one of the type leader ladies at the church said to me, they don't need to know. And I said, but I feel like I'm living a lie. And she said, no, they don't need to know because some people aren't ready to accept it. So that is hard because, yes, I did do wrong, but that's not me now.
John, the CRC client we heard from earlier, is very anxious about losing his flat. His caseworker, AJ Phillip, who's now finished up work, was hoping John won't lose all the gains he's made and will continue to develop his talents.
I mean, from early impressions of meeting John, he's always been quite articulate and able to kind of express, you know, an articulate opinion about things, and things don't always go to plan, but John doesn't believe in mobile phones, which makes contact and arranging things difficult sometimes. But you know, these
all
things.
Right.
We, you know, maybe having a diary one time would
I've got one.
That's good. Is that a recent thing?
This is a recent thing. This is something that happened last Thursday.
Congratulations. I'll
there you
part
go.
Ways with you knowing that you can keep a diary. This is good news. It took 2 years, but we got there.
The names of the former prisoners speaking in this program have been changed to protect their identities. Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical production by Andrei Shabanov. The executive producer is Chris Bullock. And I'm Anne Arnold.
On Rear Vision, High Tech Heaven. Australian defence spending from the F-111 to the F-35.
We understand that the high and rising cost of defence equipment must be accepted in an area where second best is not nearly good enough.
Getting the technological edge in buying state-of-the-art aircraft has always been important in Australia's defence policy. But at what cost? You can download this revision from the RN website.